going to say much, except this is Bill Nolte, and he's from genomics and computer science. Right? Primary is genomics, I assume. Right?
Yeah.
Well, these guys have your bio, so anything else you want to say about it? Go ahead.
All right. So, thanks. I'm going to be talking today about a couple different projects that have been going on in my lab. I assume that you all have at least some informatics background, but I don't assume too much background. If I assume too much, you should interrupt me. You know, I have way more slides than I'll probably be able to cover. This is that is fine if we stop and talk about the first topic in great detail and don't get onto the other ones. It's fine with me. There's three different topics that I've prepared slides to talk about. The first two are closely related, and the third is less closely related. So. The first two are essentially the classical and a newer approach to the same basic underlying problem, having to do with looking for occurrences of transcription factor binding sites in DNA. And the third has to do with finding remote evolutionary relationships among the protein sequences. So, everybody here has seen a logo like this before, is that true? One person's nodding, one person's not. Okay, so. Okay, so I'm going to be talking for the first two-thirds of the talk about the occurrences of motifs, and primarily we're going to focus on DNA motifs, where by motif I just mean a short subsequence of DNA that is evolutionarily conserved. So among different DNA sequences that share a common ancestor, you see a similar pattern, and then that pattern looks different than what you would expect to see just by chance. So actually, let me give you a more concrete example. Here is a splice site motif. So if you look at places in protein-coding genes in the human genome where splicing occurs, here's the intron exon boundary. And you'll typically see a GT on the intron side of that boundary. So this is a representation of that, where we're saying there's always a GT here. These are so-called canonical splice sites. But it's showing that there's slight preferences for other nucleotides at nearby positions. So you always have a G and a T at those positions, but sometimes you have an A, or maybe a G, but very rarely a C or a T at this position, for example, and so on. So this is a graphical representation of an underlying probability model that's essentially assuming each site is independent and assigning a probability to each letter at each location. So you can think of this whole thing as a motif, and the task is to go scan through a DNA sequence and find where that motif occurs in some statistical sense. Okay, here's another motif. This is for CTCF. CTCF is one of the major transcription factors in the human genome. It's one of the most specific factors, so typically a transcription factor has a short, 8 to 12 base pair binding motif. This one is on the order of 19 to 20 bases wide, with some very specific positions. So position 14 really prefers to see a G in that position, and if you change that, the efficiency of binding goes way down. Whereas some other positions are more or less don't care. Position 11, you can have anything there, and it will bind pretty well. Okay. When you want to score a particular position with a motif, the typical way it's done is to compute a log odds or log likelihood ratio, comparing the probability that you have observed in known occurrences of this motif with what you would expect to see by chance in the background. So this is I should have used a DNA example. This is a protein example. So here are all the amino acids. These are different positions in the motif. And we're basically saying, if you want to score this particular sequence, you retrieve the corresponding values from here and add them up. These particular scores are log odd scores that have been scaled and integerized just to make the calculation efficient.
Does this know? I'm probably eukaryotes or eukaryotes?
Eukaryotes, prokaryotes, either one, they're going to have some kind the notion of a motif is so broad that it can apply to both to proteins and to DNA, for example. And within DNA, it doesn't have to just be DNA binding motifs. There can be other kinds of, like the splice site motif that I showed you. So it doesn't. It's not specific to any particular kingdom. Yeah.
So that first column is the first three DNA nucleotides.
Well, yeah. So that's why I was saying I should have used a DNA motif. This is a protein motif, right?
Right.
So this is it's the first amino acid. So it would correspond to three underlying nucleotides. But in this representation, we're just considering the amino acid sequence.
Okay. And how do you generate these numbers, I guess?
The numbers are generated essentially by taking known occurrences of the motif. So they have to be identified in some fashion. You know, if it's a binding site, you might do a CellEx assay or some other footprinting assay where you say, I know it occurs in these dozen sequences, and use that to get statistics. So you say, you know, I saw out of my dozen sequences a G 11 out of 12 times, and a T one time. And you put some pseudo counts in some priors to smooth them, and then divide through by your background probabilities, and take the log. And that gives you log odds. Okay. So in practice, if you take, so I took a published motif representation of that CTCF binding motif, the same one that I showed you a few slides ago. And I did this procedure where you could calculate log likelihood ratios across all of chromosome 21, human chromosome 21. And this is the position, the strand, and the sequence and the corresponding score sorted by score. So the position that matches the motif most strongly in human chromosome 21 is at this particular position, and the score is 26.3. So this is in log odds, so you know, you're talking about 10 to the 26th more likely to have been generated by this motif than just by chance. That's an extremely strong match to the model. But of course, it's not surprising because you searched the whole chromosome, right? And so you have to somehow take into account the fact that you've got all these different possible sites to consider. So what I want to talk about is, spend a little bit of time talking about, is how you figure out whether or not that the score that you observe at any particular location is statistically significant, right? You've got some motif here, some sequence that you've observed. You do a calculation, just that simple adding up of log likelihood ratios, and you get a score out, and now you want to know, I know if it's low, especially if it's negative or close to zero, that this is not a significant match. If it's really high, it probably is, but how high is high enough, and how do we set a statistical threshold on that? So one way to do that is to do it empirically. So a standard thing to do in sequence analysis is use an empirical null model where you just shuffle all of your sequences and then redo whatever the operation is that you were doing. So in this example, I took human chromosome 21 and I shuffled the bases uniformly at random. And then I took the same real CTCF motif and scanned it again and made a histogram of the resulting scores. So that's what this is a picture of. And what you can, it shows you pretty clearly that if you get a score of 26, that's pretty significant, right? It doesn't even show up in the empirical distribution. So this is a reasonable way to do things, but it doesn't actually, it's a little bit expensive because you have to do the whole thing twice. And it doesn't actually give you a very precise estimate of your statistical confidence. So this is actually a zoom in. So here it looks like the distribution stops at about there, but it's just because there's so many scores here that you can't see. The tail actually goes out like this. So this is the same distribution, just zoomed in on the tail. And what I want to focus on right now is the empirical null. So these are the counts of the number of sequences that's got a score, say, between 16 and 16.1, for example, and that makes one bar here. And what you can see is, even in the empirical null, there was one guy that got a score of 26.3 or so, which was the highest score that we saw from the real human sequence, right? So there's a non-zero p-value associated with this from this empirical null model. But if you actually had an analytic null, something that gave you the true null distribution, you can see that that's pretty darn unlikely, right, at the end of it. So the question is, how do you get this line, right? that's what I'm going to tell you next, is instead of having to shuffle the whole thing and search again, you can actually calculate what the theoretical distribution should look like. Before I go into that, though, I want to make sure, you all, is the notion of p-value comfortable, familiar to all of you? Or should I go over that again? And what about, say, false discovery rate correction? Have you heard of that? There's one, at least one. Okay, so when we get to that, I will go into that in more detail. But the driving idea is you have some null hypothesis, some null distribution. You've got some observed score. I think this one is 17. And you want to calculate the area under the curve to the right to get a p-value. So the way that we can do this for a standard motif is to use a dynamic programming algorithm to actually enumerate all possible scores for all sequences that could ever match this particular motif. So the way this is done, I'll go through the steps. It's relatively straightforward. Let's say that these are your log likelihood ratios from your actual model. So this is saying, for example, that it really prefers to have a T in the first position, and it wants to have either a G or an A in the second position, and so on. You then linearly rescale these values so that they go from 0 to 100, or whatever value. 100 is usually enough precision to give you a pretty good distribution. And then convert them to integers. So here's the rescale version. 4.0 goes to 100, negative 3 goes to 0, and everything else just gets linearly rescaled in between. Okay. The reason to convert to integers is that this allows us to do the dynamic programming and efficiently calculate the distribution of all possible scores. So here's how it works. So how many of you have heard the term dynamic programming before? 1, 2, 3. Okay, so dynamic programming is not actually a way of programming, it's more like a mathematical construct. If in math class you learned about, mathematical induction, it's the same basic idea. Or in programming, if you learn about recursion, it's the same basic idea. But the core idea is you have some problem that you are able to solve by making a very simple version of the problem, and then show how to get from a simple version to a slightly more complicated version. And if you can do that repeatedly, you can get to solve a big version of the problem. So in our case, what we're going to do is make a matrix where the number of rows corresponds to the length of the motif that you're interested in. And the number of columns corresponds to all possible scores. So this is why the integerization is important, because by converting to integers between 0 and 100, we now have a maximum possible score and a discrete number of possible scores. So if your motif is width 4, you can only get a maximum score of 400. In fact, for this one, you can't even get to 400 because there's only 100 in there. But clearly, 400 is an upper bound on what you could get as a score. And so what we're going to do is the entry in row I, column J, is the number of different sequences of length I that can have a score of J. And hopefully the base case is easy. If you only consider sequences of length 1, there's only 4 of them, and you can easily write down, well, you can either have an A, in which case you get a 10, or you can have a C, in which case you get a 60, a G gives you a 0, or a T gives you a 100. Okay? Now the inductive step is to go from length 1 to length 2, from a given length to the next length. And the key idea here, sorry, I'm going the wrong direction. The key idea here is you essentially say, for each value in the second column of your motif, you're going to essentially add that to each value in this row. So you say, from here, I could see an A next, in which case I'd get a 77 showing up there. Or you can do any combination. So 10 plus 67, 10 plus 39, 10 plus 71, and so on. And hopefully, pretty clearly, there's 16 different possibilities, right? Because there's 4 things here and 4 subsequent letters for each. It doesn't seem like we're saving much time, but the reason this works in general is that later you'll start having more than counts of larger than 1 show up over here, where you say there's actually 3 or 4 different sequences that could have a score of 100. And then in the subsequent step, you just consider those all jointly. You don't have to separately consider all the ways to get a score of 100. And so you can keep doing this procedure until you get down to the bottom. And the bottom is like that histogram that I showed you before. The last row contains the number of sequences that have score of 0, 1, 2, all the way up to the maximum. And you can just read off a p-value from there. You basically say, okay, there's this many possible sequences, and how many are greater than the one that I observed. Right. So that's what I just said. So that gives you, think of the final row of that matrix as containing all of the counts for all the different possible sequences. And then you've got the actual exact p-value for any particular score. The only caveat being that you've had to integerize the scores. So it's not, it's only inexact insofar as you've lost some precision in the initial step. What do you think? Makes sense? Okay, so this is useful because it allows you to say, to give some kind of confidence to any particular occurrence of a given motif. You're scanning for occurrences of the CTCF motif. Now, instead of just getting some arbitrary score, you get a p-value which has a well-defined semantics associated with it. The final thing is to do some kind of multiple testing correction. The basic notion is represented here. I'm using the empirical null distribution to explain, but the same thing could be done with the exact distribution I just described. The red shows the distribution of scores I get when I scan the actual sequence of human chromosome 21. That sequence contains lots of actual occurrences of this binding motif. So the tail of this distribution is larger. There's more of these guys because these represent actual binding sites. If you want to hand someone, or you want you're the programmer writing this tool, and you want to hand someone a collection of binding sites with a well-defined error rate, usually what people use is the false discovery rate, which essentially says, here's a set of hypothesized binding sites, and here's an estimate for how many of those are wrong. And you can get that by setting your score threshold, I used 17 here, and counting how many of the actual occurrence, how many scores for the actual occurrences were greater than that, which was 519, and then how many were greater than 17 when I turned it into a null distribution. And in that case, you only get 35. So that gives you an estimate that there's about that many errors in my red set. So I've got about a 6.7% false discovery rate. And obviously, you could do that for any given threshold along here. Once you get out to here, you get pretty low false discovery rate because there's only that one die above that has a higher score. Okay. So if you need to do this sort of thing, there's a toolkit called the Mean Suite, which is a set of tools that are designed to do sequence analysis on the basis of motifs. There's a lot of other tools in the toolkit for finding motifs, you know, discovering them de novo, comparing to known compendia of motifs. FIMO, which stands for Find Individual Motif Occurrences, just implements the algorithm that I just described to you, including both the dynamic programming and the subsequent multiple testing correction. So you can drop in a motif file in one of a number of different formats that are produced either by our tools or by someone else. You can use a supported database, so this has lots of organism-specific databases and also generic databases for protein motifs. Or you can just upload a file that you want to search, and then it will actually email you the results because it can take a while to run the algorithm. And you can specify some threshold. If you specify the p-value threshold for the output, but it will also report so-called Q values, which are essentially the false discovery rate, like I just described on the previous slide. Any questions? All right. So that is a fairly standard, almost classical approach to reasoning about sequence motifs. Okay, and the second project I want to tell you about is a more it's a newer approach that tries to take into account more information than just the primary sequence.
Actually, I have a question.
Yeah.
So, how are the motifs actually used to look at? I guess do you look at sort of between organisms, or between evolutionary? What do you do with these motifs once you actually have the scores, I guess?
Yeah. So it depends on what you're interested in. You certainly can. So, for example, there are papers in which people look at the evolution of the regulatory code among yeasts. So there's a nice Nature paper from Aviv Regev's group where they basically look at how the binding profile of, you know, 20 different yeast species, how for a given transcription factor, how does that change over evolutionary time? So that's one kind of example. I think often the interest is in trying to understand within humans how one or a couple of transcription factors work together to regulate genes. So you say, okay, in this particular cell type, we've got these factors expressed, and these three factors will all bind proximal to one another and jointly recruit appropriate machinery to turn this gene on. And that's really, I think, what drives a lot of the research. Other questions? Okay, so the second project was just published a few months ago, where we were interested in using newer high-throughput data sets to build more sophisticated models of transcription factor binding. So these are models in which, rather than sort of treating each position in the motif independently, we're going to aggregate across a larger data set and then try to build a model that can take into account correlations within the motif sequence, and also maybe possibly information proximal along the genome. So to bind, not only does the DNA need to see this, but maybe it has cofactors that bind with it, and so on. So, it's joint work with these people who are at Memorial Sloan Kettering. So it's kind of hard to see this, but that's all right. It's just a sort of a generic picture to show you that, hey, DNA, transcription factors bind to DNA. Here's a transcription factor. Here's another factor. Here's the DNA sequence, and they're coming in a sequence-specific fashion and binding. And so we want to understand the mechanism of how this guy figures out where to bind. Okay. And so, as I said before, this is the usual way to represent this stuff using this kind of position-specific scoring matrix. But we know that even with the fancy stuff I showed you, you're going to get a lot of false positives. I use CTCF because it's a very specific motif, but if you look at a motif that's more standard, like this one, this only has really, about 6 or 7 informative positions in it. If you scan the human genome with this, there are so many positions that randomly look like that that you can't tell them apart from the real binding sites. So there's got to be more information that we can make use of, and the hypothesis driving this work is that, first of all, considering each position independently is an insufficient model. That it may be that you really need to have a C here, or maybe a G, but if you have a G, then you really need to have the A over there. You know, that those kind of dependencies may exist that are lost by this completely independent model. And also that there may be additional information nearby to make use of. And then it's also, the other thing driving this work is the fact that there are newer technologies that give us richer data to work from. And there are two particular technologies that I'm going to tell you about. One of them is called a protein binding microarray. So this is a canonical representation of a PBM from this paper from 2006. The basic idea is that you're going to tile a microarray with designed strands of DNA that are designed such that they contain all possible 10-mer sequences, bless you. And then what you're going to do is essentially wash a particular transcription factor over this array and put a little GFP tag on the factor so that you can then take a picture of the array and say which probes did it prefer to bind to? So this gives you an in vitro representation of what are the binding preferences for a particular factor. Okay. So the standard way to analyze this data, there's actually two different approaches. One of them is to just go through the array for the factor, look for all of the sequences that it binds strongly to, and aggregate them into one of these position-specific scoring matrices. So, yeah.
Sorry, I don't understand. Are the probes on the protein or the probes on the DNA?
So these are DNA, right? And this guy here is the protein. He's a transcription factor. Okay.
The protein, does the protein maintain the original?
That's the hope, yes. I mean, it's an in vitro assay, so if there's other, you know, if there's confirmations that are required to reach a particular confirmation, if there are other factors that have to be involved, this will be an inaccurate assay. But for most factors, I think it's reasonable to think that the confirmation is the same. But yes, that is a caveat. Okay, so there's one approach is to just take this very rich data set and boil it down to this simple model, which essentially is unsatisfying because you actually have a lot of data on this array, and you've summarized it in, you know, just a few parameters. The other approach is this enrichment score approach that one of the groups that developed the method used, which is essentially just making a list of all the probes that have strong binding, and using that list as a representation of the motif. So it's pretty unwieldy. You get a sort of an enrichment score based on a hypothesized binding site. You look at how much that particular one is enriched in the patterns that are that are in this collection over here. But it's pretty clunky, and as we'll show, it doesn't actually work that well. So the second technology that's driving this work is ChIP-seq experiments. So how many have heard of ChIP-seq? One. Okay. Chromatin immunoprecipitation is the CHIP, and seq is high-throughput sequencing. So the protocol is described here. The basic idea is this is now an in vivo assay. So you have a population of cells, and these are representation of the nucleosomes here, and you have some particular factor that you're interested in. So this is some transcription factor now. You use an antibody to pull down, to immunoprecipitate the DNA that is bound to that factor. And there's actually a sonication step where you break up the DNA into small pieces. And the idea is that if you then, the first step, of course, is you have to cross-link these to make sure that the factor stays stuck to the DNA. Then you sonicate, pull them down with an antibody. And so you get just that factor with the DNA it's bound to. And then you can release the cross-links, sequence the DNA that you got, and hopefully now you get a nice picture of where exactly this particular factor bound in view. So that's what this is showing here. There's actually different variants. There's lots of different ways to do the sequencing down here and so on, but the end result, however you do the readout, is you get something that says along the human chromosome or whatever organism you're working in, there's a whole bunch of sequences that all pile up right at this one little location. That gives you a peak in your readout. And so then you hypothesize that there was a binding event that led to that peak. So there's a whole bunch of analyses. This is from a particular review article talking about all the conundrums that people face in making sense out of this data. But one that we're interested in here is in trying to characterize the sequence preferences for this factor on the basis of this large data set. So for any given assay, you might get thousands of locations where it binds in a eukaryotic genome. So how do you summarize all those, similar to the PBM? Okay, so the approach that I'm going to take in this part of the work is, as opposed to the model that we described before, which was sort of a generative model where you're saying each position is generated independently. Now we're going to use discriminative machine learning methods. And discriminative means that you're providing two different classes of data, one that you're interested in this case and one that you're not interested in, and you're learning to discriminate between the two groups. So in our case, the two classes are data that is positions in the genome that are bound and positions in the genome that are not bound. Or similarly, probes on the PBM that fluoresce and probes that do not fluoresce. And we're trying to learn how to tell the difference between those two. Okay, so that's what this is showing. You either have the PBM or you have the ChIP-seq data, and then you're going to learn a model, a particular kind of model called a support vector machine, that discriminates between those two classes. Once you have that model, you can apply it to a chromosome and say, okay, it looks like there's a strong peak at this location, so my model predicts binding at that position. So in a sense, it's very similar to the dynamic programming I showed you before, but it's more agnostic about the mechanism. We're going to use a sort of generic framework so that it doesn't make assumptions about independence of positions. Okay. So the modeling paradigm that we use, the support vector machine algorithm, is a popular algorithm for doing classification. It's similar to many other kinds of algorithms, some of which may be familiar if you've heard of Fisher's linear discriminant. That's the classical statistical algorithm that essentially does a very similar sort of thing. If you've heard of artificial neural networks, they are also doing something very closely related to what a support vector machine does. But one of the things that makes the support vector machine powerful is its ability to use something called a kernel. We're not going to go into great detail on kernels. It's a mathematical formalism for representing various types of data. But I'll give you a simple example, the kind that we use in this particular work, which is, you can think of the problem as, imagine you have some kind of method that is designed to work on vectors, so fixed length sequences of numbers, right? And lots of mathematical constructs are defined in terms of vectors and matrices and so on. Sequences are obviously not vectors. It's not obvious how to represent them as vectors. So here's one simple way. If you have each sequence, think of these each as a different DNA sequence that you're testing for whether or not binding occurs in this particular sequence. You can have the vector be indexed by all possible three-letter sequences. So TTA occurs once here, and GCT occurs twice in this particular one, and ATG doesn't appear at all. Now, last time I did this talk, someone pointed out that it's not a perfect slide, because there's a TTA there that's not marked. But the idea is there anyway. So you basically count the number of occurrences, and then you can throw away the original sequences and say, we're just going to treat this vector as our representation of the sequence. Okay. This is a powerful way to represent sequences. You can get a little bit more information if you use what's called a mismatch representation, where you use longer sequences, but you allow for inexact matching. So we basically say, how many times does something that looks like this occur in this sequence? Where looks like means it's the same except for at most one mismatch. So GCTTA is the same as TATTA. Oh no, sorry, that's right. There's a one there. So TATTA occurs one time there. It occurs in this one as well, even though it's AATTA, because we've got a mismatch there. And you can show that empirically, this gives you a better representation of the sequence in terms of the ability to discriminate between classes, because it sort of aggregates over similar but not identical subsequences. So, if you think of this kernel representation as being sort of a bag of counts of the number of different subsequences that occur, it has some nice properties. So one thing is that if you're looking at sequences of length 5, this can keep track of dependencies that are over, you know, up to 5 different, a span of up to 5 positions. So that's a nice feature in itself. You can also imagine that rather than only getting statistics from where the binding actually occurs, you can get statistics about what's happening nearby. So is there some other cofactor, or does the overall DNA flexibility have to be high or low based on what is the overall GC content in that region, for example? And are there two or three different factors that all have to bind jointly? So we tested this by essentially seeing how well a classifier can learn to discriminate between, essentially, imagine you have two different protein binding microarrays, and they're tested, they're applied to the same system. This happens to be yeast and mouse, three different experiments. But they're two different arrays, so they're designed with different sequences on them. So we train on one of those, and then see how well we can predict the high-ranking probes on the other microarray design. So we're comparing to Emax, which is this the enrichment score that I described before, sort of the existing method, versus the support vector regression, a regressor that is trained using this kernel representation. And the performance metric that we use is how well can we recover, can we correctly predict what are the top 100 probes for a given factor. So you say, I've got a data set trained with this PBM for this factor, now let's predict for this other PBM for the same factor. So obviously 100 would be perfect, nobody gets that high, some of them get up to like 60%. But the key point here is that this is the line y equals x, so any point that's above the line means that this SVR, this support vector regression, is doing a better job of summarizing and making predictions of the PBM binding. Is that clear? Here is mud. Yeah. Yes.
What is the sequence you only calculate? You only look at the composition. You only look at the order of sequence.
That's right. That's right. So you're only looking at the overall composition. You're not requiring, say, that this guy appear before that guy or what have you. Although you can convince yourself, if you think about it, that if someone handed you, especially for like the five mer representation, counts of how many of these things occurred, you probably could cobble it back together, right? I mean, the information is there, but it's mostly compositional. So that's a good point, and it's something that there are kernels that exist that try to take positional information into account as well. We didn't do that in this one. Other questions? So remember that this is in vitro data, so this is just how the factor binds to DNA sequences on an array. But the interesting thing is that we can train a support vector regressor, train our model on in vitro data, and then use it to make predictions on in vivo, so on the ChIP-seq experiments. So the particular performance measure we're using is the area under a receiver operating characteristic curve, which actually some of you are probably familiar with. But basically, it's a trade-off of the number of false positives versus the number of true positives for varying sensitivity thresholds. the take-home message is 1.0 is perfect and 0.5 is chance. So that's what you're seeing here. And what you can see is that in each case, if you take the PBM, the support vector machine, support vector regression, trained from the microarray, and use it to predict where the peaks are in a ChIP-seq experiment, it does best, it does better than if you just did a position weight matrix, for example, also derived from the PBM. And then I'm not going to, you can ignore the occupancy problem. So that was encouraging. You can go from in vitro to in vivo. It's also encouraging that we can, if we have multiple in vivo experiments, you can get even better performance. So if you've done a ChIP-seq experiment, and you want to make predictions in, say, a different cell line for the same factor, you can do that. So this is, now we're training the SVM on the peaks identified in the ChIP-seq versus discriminating non-peak things, nearby non-peak things. And we just compared this to how well you can do using motif discovery methods, so methods that just use position weight matrices. These are two standard existing methods. And again, you see that the, using the support vector regression really, really improves your accuracy. What I think is more, even more compelling is, in addition to getting better accuracy, you can also sort of tease apart what the support vector regression is doing by doing this sort of analysis. So what we did was projected from the high-dimensional space that's defined by this kernel, using multidimensional scaling to project down into a two-dimensional space so that you can actually see what's going on. These are the things that are predicted to have binding, and you can see that there's two different groups for this particular chip-derived model. So what you're seeing is this factor binds SOX2. This is the SOX2, that's the name of the transcription factor. But it also has a cofactor called OCT4. And so the pattern of things that it's picking up is identifying both of these, both the blue points and the red points. In particular, there are a lot of things that if you only looked for the one motif, if you just use the SVM derived from the PVM, from the in vitro data, our model fails to identify these guys because it doesn't know anything about the cofactor. Right? This is the problem of using in vitro data. But if you use the model that's trained from the in vivo data, now for these guys it can actually figure out, it actually assigns them a high score because it knows that sometimes SOX2 looks like this other factor. Questions about that? All right. So I usually give the classes I've been teaching recently are longer. So this is only a 50-minute class, right? So I planned for too much content. So what I'm going to do is just tell you briefly about this idea, and if anybody's interested, I'm happy to tell you about it more at great length sometime later. But it's a very different thing, and it's sort of a little bit weird to change gears so dramatically in the last 4 minutes. So I'm just going to make it brief. Stop and you can ask questions. But the basic idea is if you are looking for remote homologs between proteins, so you have some protein that you're interested in, and you want to find other guys in the non-redundant database that are evolutionarily related to it, you go to BLAST and at NCBI and you drop it into there and you click and it comes back with a ranked list and it says here's the guy that's most closely related, second most closely, and so on. And that's a very familiar thing to do. But there's a very strong analogy between that and Google, right? So I gave a talk in Slovenia, so I used the Slovenian version of Google. But in Google, you drop in a query, it goes and looks for something and then gives you back a ranked list. And in fact, you can make the argument that there's a web of connected documents that Google is searching, you can think of proteins as a web of connected protein sequences where the edges represent similarities. And so what we've done in this work essentially is to think about, this is a picture of the internet, actually about 10 years ago, but you know it's just the major nodes of the internet. And we think of the protein universe as being similar. And can we use the same kind of graph traversal techniques that made Google so successful to give really good rankings of proteins? And so that's what this is just sort of showing you a history of the different approaches. And the key idea for this particular work is that we're going to use the existing tools to learn to project our proteins into a space where they're easily classifiable. And this is work that's driven actually by a lot of work in information retrieval, and we're just sort of stealing methods from that other field and showing that they work very well for protein homology detection. There's also a neat feature in the second half that I'm going to tell you about where you can actually make use of structural information as well to improve the learning, even though the structural information won't be available when you do the final query. And in the end, you get much better performance. I'll just skip to the
final numbers. Basically, this is our method, and it's compared to the best existing method, which is HH search. And you're looking at the number of positives versus false positives across many, many different clearing proteins, and you're getting a significant improvement in your ability to retrieve really distantly related protein sequences. So I will stop there and see if there are any questions. For the,
what was your N?
You mean the number of examples?
Yes.
So it differs by experiment, but it's so it's usually on the order of a couple hundred for the PBMs. For the ChIP-seq, it's larger. It can be probably on the order of 1,000 for each class. That's very quick to solve for an SVM. We have done methods that for other tasks that scale up to tens of thousands of examples.
You said that someone had looked into that data using the sequences as a list.
Yeah.
If you get back to that later.
So that was the horizontal axis on the one that showed Emax versus our method.
Got
so
it.
That was how they had used their list to get scores. And I was showing that our method was giving better recovery of the...
Wait, I thought that Emax was a position-specific scoring matrix.
No, that was a different one. So in the paper, we also show how it compares to the position-specific scoring matrix. But that particular result I showed you was for the sort of the bag of probes.
Is there an explanation for that?
So, I think it's two explanations. One, there's overfitting that you can easily get overfitting if you use a model that's essentially the bag of words is tons and tons of parameters, right? So, you want to trade off between underfitting by reducing it down to a position-specific scoring matrix and overfitting by just keeping all the data around. And then I think also, probably it's not an optimal scoring procedure. They have a fairly ad hoc method for coming up with, given this bag of probes and this candidate, how do you get an enrichment score? And it's not clear what's the best way to do that. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.